How many of you have a job? How many of you, okay, keep your hands in the air. How many of you that aren't, hands aren't in the air, have had a job? Okay, that's pretty much everybody here. And you put your hands down because you're tired, right? Okay, you're tired of work. A lot of different jobs, right? We could spend the rest of the time we have together talking about the variety of jobs that are represented in a gathering like this. But if you took time to go back to the beginning of that job, it might be a new job for you, or it's a career job. You've been in it for a very long time, or you just recently wrapped it up. You're retired. You share in common this fact. You probably, the company or business or entity that you worked for, put out some kind of a posting, right? And in the posting, it could, you know, it's done a lot of different ways today, LinkedIn, and, you know, there's electronic job postings. I saw them, I was roaming around with this on my mind recently, and I see signs in windows of stores saying, yeah, help wanted, some form of help wanted, hurry, we need you kind of thing. And so people respond to that. They hear that there's a job offer, and they go in, they fill out an application. Perhaps it's the kind of job that actually asks for a resume, and you put together a profile, sort of an impressive look at you. And then you have a little interview that follows that. Sometimes it's quick, sometimes it's a series of interviews. But eventually, an offer is made by whoever it is that interviewed you, and you are faced with a decision. If you got the job, that means you said yes to the offer. All right? Just kind of capturing it all rather quickly. Then a start date is established. If they're desperate, they say, can you start right now? Right? And then you start your job. And when the offer is made, it likely includes a couple things. A beginning pay rate, either hourly or salary. This is what we start you at. And then with the beginning pay comes a benefit package of some kind. It may not be real big. It may involve standard things on a career type job of medical and dental and vacation and maybe a matching contribution to some kind of a retirement plan or a 401k, 403b, or whatever it happens to be. Now, remember your first paycheck. Stay with me for a sec on that job that you're remembering. Okay? It was either weekly or biweekly, or in some cases, this is still done, monthly. And it was either a check, a hard check, a physical check handed to you, or today, more likely, a direct deposit. So you get your money quicker. Right? So it's there, and it's, you don't have to worry about losing a check. Now, after verifying that the numbers are correct on this check I'm having you remember, which basically is total number of hours worked times pay per hour equals gross pay, right? And then after the government gets a hold of it, I'm resisting all kinds of comments right now, okay, just not. My oldest daughter is in her early days of her career, and her very almost predictable first reaction after she got her first paycheck, after working a ton, is, what happened here? And I again, resisted all sorts of comments, but I have a question now. How many of you, when you got that check, ran up to your boss and gave him or her a big hug and said, wow, I can't believe you gave me that much. I don't deserve it. This has got to be a mistake. I tell you what, here, let's split it in half. You take half back. Raise your hand. Because if you do, you need help. You need help. That's not normal. Now, you're thinking, are you crazy? Because you got your paycheck. It's yours. We say when we get that check, it's mine. I earned that. I deserve that. And probably for some of you, from the very first check, you start to think of ways to make yourself more valuable, more necessary, and what comes with that is not half the check, but twice the check. Maybe you weren't that ambitious, but you get the idea. Everything I just said about jobs is true. Romans 4, verse 4, makes this interesting observation, very succinct words. Now, to the one who works, wages are not credited as a gift, but as an obligation. So, in other words, that imaginary scene I had you think about, that's totally off the charts because you deserve what you got. They didn't gift you a paycheck. They gave you what is obligated to you because of the arrangement that was established. Now, for every one of us who's accustomed to working for a wage, today's talk is a pretty tall mountain. When the Bible offers grace as a gift that can't be bought, cannot be bought, isn't earnable, and has never once been deserved, two things almost always happen in the mind of the hearer. One is confusion. Huh? It can't be earned, it can't be bought, it has never been deserved. Wait a sec, how can that be? There's confusion. And then, unless I miss my guess, what follows shortly after confusion is suspicion. Wait a minute. Where's the catch? Did you just say it's free? It's better than words can describe. It's a gift, can't be deserved, can't be earned. Where's the catch? This morning, my message is really aimed at addressing the confusion, if there is some, and I suspect there is, and the, with it, suspicion. Really? Grace is free? Last week, you recall that we established something about God right from the beginning in this series called Grace, More Than We Deserve, Greater Than We Can Imagine. And we went back to the beginning, Exodus 34, and when we spent time there, we quickly realized in a self-description, God, meeting with Moses, had a limitless potential for explaining who he was to Moses, because he had a big assignment for Moses, but as you and I would have needed to hear at that moment. So God, since this is such a big deal, turns out it's the biggest deal ever recorded in the Bible, with the exception of Jesus Christ. It's the most talked about miracle in the Bible, the deliverance of God's people, the Exodus as it's known in the Bible, where God takes his people from slavery and sets them free from Egypt, eventually to the so-called promised land, the land of flowing of milk and honey, their homeland. And it was a miracle that was so big, it's talked about everywhere in the Bible. And God says to Moses, listen, in order for you to trust me and lead my people, I got to tell you who I am. And so he starts by saying, I am, Exodus 34, verse 6, I am the Lord, I am the Lord. Meaning, this is never going to change. I'm telling you this in a repeated sort of way so that you know this will always be true. I am gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in loving kindness. Now, I just quoted Exodus 34, verse 6. But I could very easily, if time permitted, take you to Nehemiah 9, Psalm 103, Psalm 86. Throughout the Bible, this self-description is put in front of people. As though God says, listen, let's never forget who it is talking to you. I am gracious and compassionate. I am God. That's the Old Testament. But as soon as you open the pages of the New Testament, you find something remarkably consistent. Jesus Christ, who is known as God in the flesh, Emmanuel, which means God with us, according to Matthew chapter 1, verse 23. His first description used of Jesus Christ to a front row observer. My Bible, by the way, now is open to John chapter 1. If you'll turn there, we'll spend a couple of moments there, and then we're going to shift gears and go to Matthew chapter 20. So John chapter 1, it's the fourth of four Gospels. Now we'll be looking at the same words together here. Some on the sides, we need more lights on the sides. Scott, find somebody that can do that, would you? Thank you. I suspect it's not quite bright enough. There we go. All right. So when I call him a front row observer, John, the writer of this gospel, do you know who we're talking about? His brother's named James. James and John were fishermen. They are known in the Bible as sons of Zebedee or sons of thunder, right? And these young men had a career in fishing, and Jesus said, hey, leave your small ambitions, come follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. We're going to still go with the fishing thing, but you're fishing for souls. And they did, and John later would be the one that wrote this, the fourth gospel. And in chapter 1, John looks at Jesus and describes him as one full of glory. Look at verse 14. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. Important preposition. He came to live among us. Another translation says he pitched his tent in our neighborhood. Isn't that good? I like that. I like camping. Okay, so he made his dwelling among us, and we have seen his glory. Big word. And then he breaks down what glory looks like. The glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father. And look at this label. There's a little whiff of Exodus 34, verse 6. He came full of grace and truth. So lots of things leap out at this point. It's a consistency between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. It's the consistency of the Trinity, the Father, in this case, the Son. He came from the Father, and he came full of what you would expect, grace and truth. I am a gracious God, is how God began in Exodus 34. Jesus, not surprising, is saying, I am the same God. I came forth from the Father. So these verses establish right away the source of grace. That's why it's an adventure in missing the point. If someone sets out to be gracious in this life without being connected to the source of grace. I like road trips. Sometimes without a destination in mind. I just like getting in a car, and if you drive a truck like mine, you understand, and you just want to hit it and go. Hey, if you run out of road, no problem. It's a Chevy Silverado. So you get there any way you want to get there, right? I like road trips. But you know something I almost always do before I take a trip? I look at my gas gauge, in my case, diesel. And I make sure it's more than half tank. In fact, I make sure it's so full that I can go and go and go. Why? Well, because it would be foolish to start out on a long road trip and only have half the fuel to get there. Sometimes that's like grace for people that decide, you know, grace sounds really good. I'm going to try to be gracious. Last Sunday I made the point, listen, don't try this on your own. You'll give up because you'll find I can't, it's like my tank just went empty. I can't be this. And I abandoned my effort, just like stepping away from a vehicle that's run out of fuel. I can't get there. The point here is that we must have a connection to the source, to the supplier of grace, and that's God. And when we do, what is written next becomes our reality. Look at verse 15. John testified concerning him. He cried out, saying, "This is the one I spoke about when I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me.'" That's the incarnation. Did Jesus begin when he was born in Bethlehem? No. His earthly beginning started in Bethlehem. I've been there. But he pre-existed as God for all of eternity prior to that moment. That was just the moment when he broke into our reality. Okay, does it make sense? So John says, "He who comes after me," he's about to come, "has surpassed me because he was before me." And if you were reading these words the first time trying to make sense of this, you'd go, there's a mystery here. Look further. "Out of his fullness we have all received grace in place of grace already given." What is being said here is that grace is ours without limit. Because Jesus is the source of grace, and when we become related to the source by grace through faith, Ephesians 2 says so, "For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourself. It's a gift from God, so that no one can boast and say, 'You know, I have this relationship with God because, well, I'm a pretty good guy. You know, God pays attention to people like me.'" You ever known somebody like that? Ever been that person? It's laughable, isn't it? It's kind of crazy. Well, you know, God, he's building a team, and naturally he wants some pretty special people on that team. It's a flawed thought, but it's been thought before. Now, grace is ours without limit. I love the play on words in verse 16. "We have all received grace in place of grace already given." What's being said here is grace is ours without limit, and it's a grace that comes from a God that even gave you the grace to stop and look and listen and pay attention to this God of grace. Let's not assume everyone gets this. I want you to do a little sniffing, looking at the page, okay? Just look at the page, and I want you to look for something that's not there, okay? I want you to actually notice something missing. What is that? If God gives us grace upon grace, I gave you a little hint earlier, but what's not there? You never see the word at all. Merit. We get his grace by his grace. That's a way of saying you cannot, I cannot earn it. It is completely undeserved and totally unmerited. That is already crossing up with our standard approach to something of value, like a paycheck. Which was why I took time to have you imagine that moment. Because it's yours because you earned it. Right? It's deserved. But grace is different than that. He gives it. We get it. Period. Now, some of you are thinking right now, I'm guessing, of exceptions. You're thinking, well, that probably does apply to people like me, Pastor. Probably does. But I'm thinking of people like Billy Graham. I'm thinking of super spiritual people. I'm kind of a hack, Pastor, truth be known. Got my good days and my bad days. Days when I'm walking well and days when I stumble badly. I mean, really? But how do you explain the giants? The Bible's full of them, isn't it? I mean, and even in our life, we know that saintly mother or father, or that spiritual giant, that teacher that touched our lives. Some of you are even thinking of folks that you know here at Grace Point. Do I need to mention names? I could, but I won't. They'd be uncomfortable for me to do so. And you think to yourself, you know what? I tell you something. Most of what you're saying I buy into, but I'm pretty sure they get more grace than me. If grace is an ice cream cone, theirs is bigger than mine. Okay? And it just makes sense, right? They deserve it, after all. I mean, just look at their lives. If you're God, is that so hard to see? They've made good use of it. They get a lot of it. There have been days I have made good use of it. There's been days I haven't. True confession, there's been seasons where I haven't. I've gone off the rails, Pastor. I've left the path. Am I describing somebody you know? Do you think like that? Because if you do, I mean this with compassion, but I got to gently tell you, you're wrong. If that's your view, you're believing something that is nowhere taught in the Bible. And it may be logical to think like that, but who ever said anything about grace was logical? Jesus was renowned. If you've studied his life through the four Gospels at all, you have come to appreciate something that's sort of self-evident. He was renowned for saying things that crossed people up, that really radical stuff. Frequently, he would tell a story to an audience or to an individual, and they were certain they knew the punchline. They were absolutely confident that, I know where you're going, Jesus. And then they were humbled to hear that their conclusion was completely opposite, totally contrary to what Jesus was teaching. I have a son who excelled in basketball in high school. He still loves to play, but he's on to, pre-med, so more lucrative future, hopefully. But in high school, I loved to watch him. He's a point guard, and he had eyes for the court, and he had some great moves. He's left-handed, so it was frequent for him to come, dribble down, do a dribble drive, and then juke his opponent. He has the ball, and he jukes him by doing a crossover move. And there were times when you would just wince as you watched, because his defender literally would get locked up and trip and fall down. And you tried not to laugh out loud, but it was your son that did it. You know, that kind of thing, right? Okay, that's a crossover move. I want to show you now in Matthew 20 a parable that has everyone going left and Jesus goes right. Okay, so flip back. I told you we'd go there. And if somebody's near the thermostat, I see some of you fanning yourself. Scott, take care of that too, would you? Thanks. Matthew 20, would you? Scott's covering everything. Refreshments will be served soon, thanks to Scott. So we appreciate that a lot. All right. So Matthew 20, page 689, if you're still looking for it, that's okay. Just grab the Bible near you. Now, consider, as we read this, the illogic of salvation and the credentials necessary for entrance into heaven. Matthew 20, verse 1. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard. This is Jesus telling a story. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them into his vineyard. About 9 in the morning, as I estimate around 3 hours later, not long, around union break time, mid-morning, he went out and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. He told them, you also go and work in my vineyard and I'll pay you whatever is right. So they too went out to work. He went out again around noon, 3 hours later, again in 3 PM, and did the same thing. About 5 PM, he went out and found still others standing around. I have an image that's on my mind right now of day laborers. It's not that they're lazy. They showed up. They'd love a job. They haven't been given the job yet. So around 5 PM, he went out, found still others standing around. And he asked them, "Why have you been standing all day long doing nothing?" "Because no one hired us," they answered. And he said to them, "You also go to work in my vineyard." When evening came, now don't miss this, the math here. If they got hired at 5 and evening came, unless it's daylight savings time in Alaska in the middle of the summer, there's a good chance the sun sets in a couple hours, right? You following me? So let's just say, a couple hours later when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to the foreman, "Call the workers and pay them their wage." Here's the cross-up move. Beginning with the last ones hired and going on to the first. You find your neck snapping at that moment. The audience that heard this the first time went, "Huh? How did that happen?" As sweat falls from his head. The workers who were hired about 5 PM came and each received a denarius. So when those came who were hired first, they expected to receive, just say it out loud, more. If I was hired right after I finished my morning coffee, worked my fanny all day long, and for weird reasons that haven't been explained to me, Jesus goes ahead and pays the guys that got hired at dinner to just around dinner time first, I'm thinking, well, that's weird, but at least there's a bigger paycheck coming for me, right? Each one of them also received a denarius. Okay, I'll just say it because it's just me. I would have held my hand out for my denarius for my pay. When the first denarius was put in my hand, I would have done what? I'd have stayed there for an embarrassing amount of time. The foreman that paid me would have had to go, "Hey, you just got paid. Step aside, next." I'm like, "What? Look at me. I'm a wreck. I've been working all day long. These guys have barely broke a sweat." So verse 11 shows up. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. "Those who were hired last worked only 1 hour," they said, "and you've made them equal with us, who've borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day." And he answered one of them, "I'm not being unfair to you, friend. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Take your pay and go. I want to give the one who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I am generous?" So the last will be first, and the first will be last. Raising a great question. Who goes to heaven? And why? When Jesus had words in the chapter just before this with a rich young man who asked the ultimate question back in chapter 19, verse 16, he asked the question that every one of us at some point needs to ask. "Teacher, what good must I do to get eternal life?" Jesus' answer was, "Well, you've got to keep the commandments." Shockingly, the man said, "I've done that." You're looking at him, lawkeeper. And then Jesus says, "Well, I'll tell you something." He had no way of knowing this except Jesus is God, so he knew it. "I know you got a lot of money." My paraphrase. "It's a big factor and influence in your life. I'll just say it. It's your God. Get rid of it. Go sell it all. Dump your assets. And then come follow me." And, of course, the man, it's one of the saddest stories in the New Testament. The young man, after hearing this, verse 22 says he went away sad because he had great wealth, meaning he said, can't part with my God, small g, can't give it up. And then Jesus, seeing the reaction of the disciples who had to see this thing go down and go, seriously? Jesus, knowing that he had an audience, verse 25 tells us that their reaction was first astonishment, and then a great question was on their mind. How can someone be saved? I mean, this is a straight up guy. Had a lot of money. If he can't find his way into heaven, how can the rest of us? I mean, what chance do we have? I would have thought and might have asked, then who can be saved? Verse 25. And Jesus gave something of a hint in verse 26. With man, this is impossible. With God, all things are possible. And then adds an element of mystery at the end of verse 30. But many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first. And then guess what comes next? The story we just read. Many who are first will be last. Those who are last will be first. Suggesting that his view of who belongs in heaven, Jesus' view of who belongs in heaven, and in what order are in complete contrast to what seems normal. The word I've used a couple of times so far, logical. Reasonable, expected. This is one of those stories in the Bible where you would have been tempted to do this about halfway through. I know how it ends. Especially if it was the first time you had heard it. I know where he's going. You ever done that when a teacher's teaching? You're not doing that this morning, are you? You'd have gone like that. And Jesus said, whoa, you jumped the gun there. I'm going to cross you up. You're going left. I'm going to take it right. Which explains the meaning of this parable. Jesus is exposing the deep roots of what might be, I've given the label, the deserved deception. Would you write that down? In the last moments we have together. That's the idea, and it's a deception if you've believed it, that somehow at some level salvation is deserved. Even that superhero saint you were thinking about a little bit ago, at some level, it's deserved. You know why I know this so well? I lived a long time believing that about my dad. My dad was like, if you got the Pope here, he was way up here. All the fuss about the Pope, not for me. I lived with somebody that was a rock star above the Pope in my mind. I live with a guy that was incredibly revered, venerated, esteemed by many, many people. I never heard somebody rip on my dad or about my dad. He just had it. And I wrongly thought that, he's probably that exception. Rest of us got to work at it. We got to do something to deserve it. For a very long time, I thought, my dad, he's in. Maybe there's a little spillover effect on the rest of us in the family. I really did. And it kept me out of the kingdom of God for a while, because I had to get on my knees and realize, God has no grandsons. He wants a son in you, Steve. This might be a shock to you. We know that grace is God's unmerited favor. If you're writing notes down, that's worth keeping. But if pressed far enough, most of us have a line somewhere that separates deserved from undeserving. Jesus is in this Matthew 20 parable explaining that's really exploding the notion with a plain illustration from the world of work. If you get hired early in the day and someone else gets hired just before quitting time, you thought correctly. You did. There's nothing wrong with your logic at all. That the early hire gets paid first. And the late hire gets paid less. That's logic. So don't scold yourself. Don't go, "Wow, I was stupid." No, you're not. You're absolutely reasonable. In fact, if someone messes with the order of that, you may not say it out loud, but you know what you're thinking inside? Rip off. It's a rip off. Jesus is teaching, in contrast to all of that logical conclusion, that when it comes to grace, none are deserving. Not even my dad. Grace is saying the fact that you got hired at all defies logic. Grace is why the most common two expressions that will be heard in heaven are, "Hey, what are you doing here?" Followed by, "Say, where's so-and-so?" I've been trying to grasp this in my finite mind, and I struggle to understand these things. I feel like Paul, sometimes if you want to read a great expression by a great theologian, I'm a hack compared to him. But in Romans 11, the Apostle Paul comes to the end of a three chapter, 9, 10, and 11, mind blower. About how God grafts in Gentiles to the who are wild olive branches, as he puts it, into this native tree, and then he cuts off some native branches. He's talking about Gentiles. We have no legal right to be grafted in. And he's talking about the ones that are by nature in the tree, the Jews that didn't believe in Jesus, Messiah. They're cut off. And he's going back and forth with this. And then he comes to the end, Romans 11, verse 33. He says, "Oh, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and how unfathomable," great word, "are his ways." You ever felt that way? "Man, God, I'm trying to get to know you, but this is amazing. This is more than I can handle." I had a little imaginary moment when I was wrapping up my preparation for today. I imagined browsing a trophy case that belonged to Jesus. And I'm roaming around, and I was given permission. He said, "Hey, come on in. Make yourself at home." So I'm roaming around looking at books. Want to know what I saw on his bookshelf? I'm not going to tell you. But I did see his trophy case. And in his trophy case, I paid attention to this one, and I looked at it. And it was a woman, a trophy, and it was a woman in this trophy on display. And at the bottom were these words from Luke 7, verse 47. "She who was forgiven much, loved much." I went, wow. No wonder Jesus has that trophy. And then I looked over and I saw a picture. I could make out one of the people in the picture. It was Jesus. The other I didn't know, haven't met. But I looked a little closer at the details of the picture and I saw something that they both had in common. There were nail holes. Some scarring in both the hands of Jesus and this other unnamed person, someone I hadn't met. And then at the bottom of that, I read the caption on the picture. "Condemned by man, forgiven by God." And I realized that I was looking at the man the criminal who died next to Jesus on the cross. The man to whom Jesus said, "I will see you in heaven soon." I think St. Augustine understood everything we said this morning when he said this: "The grace of God does not find man fit for salvation, but makes them so." I'd like you to bow your heads if you would. How can that be? The grace of God does not find man fit for salvation, because there are none. Which means there's hope for you, and there's hope for me, because he gives us grace upon grace to the undeserving. I pray that today has deeply disturbed more than a few of us, Lord. Not because we're stupid and we don't get an obvious point, but because the point is anything but obvious. And I pray, God, that you would cause tire kickers, people that are wondering about you. They're not ready to take you for a test drive, and they're certainly not ready to buy, but they're saying, "Jesus, I'm curious about you." I pray that this today would have been hugely helpful from your Holy Spirit, not from me, but from you, to the hearts of searching men and women and young people. I pray that it would change the trajectory of our lives to say, "Jesus, I come to you as someone qualified. I'm undeserving. Show me your grace. Give me your life." And just as I'm blown away today by your grace and how it's offered to me when it's not deserved, I pray that would be the template for how I treat everybody I encounter this week at work, at home, at school, everywhere I go. That when they deserve something of judgment or condemnation from me, they would receive something called grace. And that would point them to you as it does to me. In Jesus' name. Thank you.